first-term Congressman Greg Landsman is trying to accomplish something no Democrat has achieved in decades, win re-election in Ohio's first congressional district. He faces Republican Orlando Sanza, the executive director of the Hamilton County Veterans Services Commission and a former Hamilton County prosecutor who has never held elected office. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Our election coverage continues today with the candidates for Ohio's 1st Congressional District, which includes the city of Cincinnati, eastern Hamilton County, and all of Warren County. You'll hear the interviews in the order they were recorded. Joining me in this recorded interview is Congressman Greg Landsman. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What are your constituents telling you they're most concerned about?
So, you know, it depends a little bit on where you are. The district is, as you just mentioned, it's one part city, the city of Cincinnati, one part, you know, the suburbs, up 71, and then one part rural Ohio in Warren County. Though mostly people are not surprisingly worried about the economy, and that's a pocketbook thing, or I like to think of it more as like a bank account. You know, there is clearly, you know, signs of, you know, a pretty significant economic recovery. You know, unemployment is down. Inflation is starting to come down. You have other things that suggest that things are heading in the right direction. However, I do think that the bank account is not where people want it to be. Their own bank account, when you think about what they're bringing in, and then the cost of everything that they need, you know, putting aside a vacation or savings, and then freedom, reproductive freedom, and just the intrusion of government, in this case, the far right, and saying, you know, look, we do think we can, that we should be banning books. Politicians should be telling, you know, schools what they can and can't teach or say, and then, you know, reproductive freedom. The border does come up. I mean, it's twofold for people. One, it's a real crisis, and they want to see their government solve it. And then, obviously, there is the concern about border security and the sheer number of people coming in and what that means. Gun violence, you know, is always top of mind, and then the climate. I mean, those are some big ones. I will say, and this is across the board, Democrats, Independents, Republicans, people are tired of the existing politics. They really are done with the chaos and the extremism, whether it's the far left or the far right. They want normal, pragmatic, bipartisan leaders. I was at a breakfast today in Mason, and almost everybody, as I was leaving, was saying, "Thank you for just being bipartisan. Thank you for being." One woman said, "Thank you for talking in a way that I was able to, you know, follow and was about the issues I care about." I mean, there's just a sort of like, are you talking about normal, and are you working on normal stuff, or have you been gobbled up by Twitter and social media?
Let's talk about the economy. Most polls, whether it's Kaiser or Pew, say the economy is the top issue for voters. How should Congress address the struggles families are facing with higher prices and other economic pressures?
So a couple things. One is you got to fix the tax code. You got to get working people and middle class folks meaningful tax relief, like big time tax relief. We passed the child tax credit in this Congress, expanding it, and supporting tax relief for small businesses, but it did not include the big, you know, tax giveaways to the super wealthy, and so it died in the Senate. Senate Republicans, you know, they want those tax giveaways to the super wealthy billionaires and big corporations. This was a tax package that was designed entirely for working people and small businesses, and it got out of a divided House. So that has to be priority one in the next Congress is, you know, put back on the books the child tax credit, expand it, make sure that it's helping families, working families who are really struggling with their bank account in terms of being able to pay all their bills and still have some money left over each month. And then you've got to rein in these prices. And so we got to negotiate lower prescription drug prices on all of the prescription drugs that are you know, bought and sold on behalf of Medicare. And you got to start getting serious about price gouging, you know, in every sector of our lives. And that's going to require pretty courageous reform. I do believe that the American people want that kind of government, a government that says, look, everyone's going to pay all their taxes. We're not going to do this anymore where the super wealthy don't pay all their taxes. They need to pay all their taxes. And we want a government that is going to sort of intervene on our behalf when it comes to prices and getting these prices down, but not invade, you know, our personal space in terms of reproductive health care. And what books are in our schools' libraries.
How are you working in Congress to increase access to affordable health care? I know that's a big question. We don't have a whole lot of time.
One of the bills that that I passed out of committee and hopefully will pass after the election is a bipartisan bill requires transparency for these PBMs or the pharmacy benefit managers that buy and sell prescription drugs on behalf of Medicare, and they make so much money. And so our bill requires them to disclose their transactions, so the savings that they achieve as they're buying and selling prescription drugs on behalf of seniors and Medicare, those savings go to seniors and Medicare, not just to shareholders. And that's one of many PBM-related reforms, but the pharmaceutical companies, and you know, I don't take corporate PAC money, so that in every one of these debates, everyone in the room knows exactly where I am. I am going to be with the folks on the other end of this, which is the user, like the hospitals, the doctors, and the patients. They are all struggling with pharmaceutical companies that are making like $100 in profit a second. I mean, $30+ billion a year. And hospitals are really struggling to pay all their bills. And then doctors, because they haven't gotten the reimbursement rate increases they need, are having a hard time, you know, and having to take on more. And then patients aren't getting all the health care. So you got to increase the reimbursement rates for both Medicaid and Medicare and get these prescription drug prices down. Those are two really important things. Now, my first bill was a bill to cap the cost of insulin for children, which I believe will pass in the next Congress. But it will probably pass as part of an effort to cap the cost of insulin across the board. I just thought if we're doing it for seniors, there's got to be a bipartisan majority of folks in the House that will do it for children, and they will. I just can't get the speaker to put it on the floor.
What about federal legislation regarding reproductive rights? What would you support along those lines?
Codifying Roe. I mean, there's going to be a national bill on this one way or the other. I mean, it's either going to be a bill to codify Roe and reproductive freedom in the United States of America, or a bill to ban all abortions. I mean, those are the two options, and so that's why this election is so important.
It's been more than a year since the Hamas-led attack that killed more than 1,000 Israelis and the deadliest attack on Jews since the Holocaust. The Israeli counterattack has killed more than 40,000 Palestinians. What should U.S. involvement be moving forward in that conflict?
Yeah, so the United States has to stand shoulder to shoulder with Israel. There should be no daylight between us and Israel when it comes to what is almost entirely Iranian-backed terror attacks. So, Israel left. Let me just, before I get there, but for Iran, I think we'd have peace. Israel has made peace with Egypt, Jordan, UAE, Bahrain. If it wasn't for Hezbollah, which is Iran and Hezbollah, we would see a peace deal between the Lebanese and the Israelis. You know, people, particularly on the ground, not the leaders as always, but people on the ground, they all want peace. The same is true for Palestinians. If you didn't have Hamas, which took over when Israel left, and instead of and got all the of this money, some of them have become billionaires outside of Gaza. I mean, lining their own pockets to the point where they are billionaires, as opposed to investing in Palestinians in Gaza. And then the money that did get to Gaza, they built hundreds of miles of tunnels where they are now, less so anymore, but they were fighting the IDF and the Israelis, as opposed to meeting them somewhere away from civilians so that there would be no civilian casualties. The civilian casualties in any war are awful, and this war has been particularly terrible because of the number of children, women and children. The dismantling of Hamas long-term, which the Israelis have done, allows for the rebuilding of Gaza and ultimately a credible governing authority in Gaza to work with a credible governing authority in the West Bank to get to peace. And if you can keep Iran out of this, there will be peace.
As a member of Congress, what laws would you support to address gun violence in this country?
So gun violence is one of the most pressing, urgent issues. It's now the leading cause of death for our children. As parents of two teenage kids who go to, you know, the same school every morning now, we just worry. All of us do. And 70-80% of Americans want common sense gun reform, and it's because we keep saying it, it's frustrating when the vast majority of Americans want it, including most gun owners. Because they know, like, it's not going to affect their gun or guns or their lives. Comprehensive criminal background checks, red flag laws that allow law enforcement to go to a judge where there's due process and a hearing and say, hey, we're worried about this person. We're going to temporarily take away their weapons. Bans on these high capacity magazines. Or the assault rifle itself, but the high capacity magazine is really the issue. If a gun has 10 rounds in it, that's one level of damage. It's not great. It's bad. Somebody may die. Several people may die. But a gun that has 100 rounds, now you're talking about mass casualties and carnage, and not to be, overly graphic, although I think part of the reason why we aren't there yet is because we have yet to see these bodies. You're talking about in Uvalde 10-year-olds, and my son, who's now almost 13 next week, unbelievable. He was 10 when it happened, and so that one hit a little bit differently because I was living with a 10-year-old, right? Like I was with him every day. I know what a 10-year-old looks like every day when they come in and out of the house. Those children, those 10-year-olds, because of the assault weapon, their bodies exploded. And, when Emmett Till was brutally killed, his mother wanted the world to see, wanted the country to own that. And it lit a fire under what was already a pretty successful civil rights movement. But it made a huge difference in people saying, "Oh, we have to be done with this." And I'm not suggesting that anyone who lost a kid to gun violence should be putting their picture out there. I'm suggesting that if we saw more of it, and not to go back to October 7th, although yesterday was October 7th, so it's top of mind. I've seen hours of footage from the day. And there's one video that I'll never forget. I don't think I'll forget any of it. But there are two children that are running away from the gunman, and the gunman has an AR-15, and they shoot the two children in the back, and you can see these little backs explode. Mm. That's happening here in the United States, and it can end. It just requires a generation of leaders that are determined to end it, and I'm going to be part of that generation of leaders.
Immigration is a big issue for a lot of voters, as you mentioned. What should the federal government be doing around immigration policy?
Two things. One, pass the bipartisan border fix, which will secure the border, the southern border, and make sure that we have enough personnel, Border Patrol and judges, and change the asylum rule so that it really is people who are seeking asylum and aren't here to work. And then separately, because you got to secure the border first, create these pathways so that folks can come here legally and work and do it in an organized way where you're filling jobs that desperately need filled.
Newsweek reported last month that you're one of eight members of Congress who may have broken a law related to the timely reporting of trades and stocks and other securities. Why were you late in reporting those trades?
I, as a new member of Congress, you do your financial disclosure, and it's different from City Hall, right? Because I've been doing financial disclosures forever. And you have a list of all the things you have to disclose. So I got used to that. Then when you get to Congress, you have to disclose the stock trades too, which is great. I have absolutely nothing to do with my stock trades. I don't understand the market. I don't know when they're trading stocks and when they're not. And in any event, once we found at the end of the year, all of the trades were there, and it got disclosed in the financial disclosure. Of course it did. You have to do it as the trade happens or some period of time after. So now it's set up where there's a additional person that goes in and reports it immediately. Ultimately, I think members shouldn't be, even though I'm not involved, you would know for certain if it were in a mutual fund or a blind trust. And so that's what we're working to sort out, which doesn't happen overnight, but doesn't take months. So, you know, I want to get to the point where I'm following the law that I believe should be in place and that I'm signed on to, which is members shouldn't have anything to do. I certainly don't, but at all with their stocks. And so because you have a lot of members who are making a lot of money, and it's wrong. So hopefully the bill passes, but in the meantime, you know, we'll get out of if for no other reason, I don't want to have to keep doing this.
What would your biggest priorities be if you are reelected to this office?
Yeah, number one, strengthen our democracy. You got to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, end voter suppression across the country, end partisan gerrymandering, get dark money. 85% of all of the money spent in this election, I read, but you can fact check me, is untraceable. So pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Number two, codify Roe, restore reproductive freedom. Three, fix the tax code so that it's built for working people and the middle class. Four, get this bipartisan border fix done. Five, pass comprehensive gun violence reform that invests in mental health, law enforcement, and gets these guns out of our communities.
Well, I have been talking with Congressman Greg Landsman, a Democrat who is seeking re-election in Ohio's 1st Congressional District. Thank you so much for your time today, Congressman Landsman.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll hear from Republican Orlando Sanza. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our coverage of the campaign for Ohio's 1st Congressional District, which includes the city of Cincinnati, eastern Hamilton County, and all of Warren County. Joining me in this recorded interview is Orlando Sanza, Executive Director of the Hamilton County Veterans Services Commission and the Republican candidate for the seat. Thanks for being here.
Lucy, thanks so much for having me. It's an honor.
It's great to have you. What are people out in the community telling you they're most concerned about?
Yeah, look, there's no doubt that first and foremost, they're concerned about the economy still. You know, when it comes to things that matters most to young families or even those that are still in the workforce and anyone in between, when you still have a rising cost of food, gas, home prices, rent, mortgage, utilities, even property taxes, especially in Hamilton County, that really is what is at the forefront of their minds, right? They want to make sure that their dollar, their hardworking dollar, tries to do as much work as it can for them. And they want to also make sure that that dollar goes as far as it possibly can to put food on the table and to continue to maintain the lifestyle that they want in order to thrive in today's America. That's, I think, bar none, the number one issue that I am hearing across the district, whether it's Delhi to Cincinnati to Mason and Springboro. Very closely tied with that, I think they're concerned with just crime and safety. You know, all this talk of the open southern border and maybe its connection or nexus to Southwest Ohio. There's no doubt, right, that there is a significant connection. You just look at the fentanyl epidemic that we have here in Southwest Ohio. There's definitely a connection with an open southern border that's allowed this drug trade to proliferate and then find its way into the artery of Southwest Ohio. You know, I'm looking at that lens from my time as a prosecutor here in Hamilton County, and then also as a concerned citizen myself trying to raise four young kids. So coupled with that is, you know, yeah, just continuing to find illegal immigrants that may not have just broken our laws in the southern border, but now have broken our laws here in Southwest Ohio. The feeling of, is our community as safe as it possibly can be? The reason why that's a huge touch point for me, right, is, again, not just as a prosecutor that's prosecuted some cases that have dealt with illegal immigrants that are defendants here in Hamilton County and prosecuted them, but as a product of legal immigration. You know, I was born in the Philippines, moved here when I was three, having the lens of absolutely we want to welcome people into this country, whether it's the Philippines or anywhere else around the world, but not in a way that immigration, not in a way that overburdens significantly Americans, whether it's economically or safety-wise. I think that's the concern, is that over 15 million illegal immigrants in the country, it's now caused a significant burden across America, especially here in Southwest Ohio. So those two issues, I think, is over and over again, as we've door-knocked thousands of doors now, I continue to hear.
You mentioned the economy. A number of polls also show that as the top of on the list of people's worries. How should Congress address the struggles families are facing with higher prices and other economic pressures?
Yeah, look, there's no doubt that when you look at this hyperinflationary environment that we are still in, right? It's not just slowing the rate of inflation, but how do you actually bring prices then down? You can't just slow the increase of prices, but then you have to bring them down. So it's a twofold problem set. As I now put, you know, my CPA hat on as a certified public accountant, looking at, it certainly doesn't take a CPA, right, with a master's in tax to know that we should not be spending more than what we make. I mean, those are basic common sense skills that I'm trying to instill in our four young kids today, you know, in good money management. So the first step, right, is to slow that rate of inflation down and stop it, is to stop government spending. Instead, look to actually wisely and reasonably cut government spending. You know, and this is something that, you know, a lot of elected officials or candidates just say on the campaign trail, well, you've got to be able to back it up. How do you specifically cut government spending? Well, this is the hard work that really we don't need to start from scratch. A lot of people don't know, but the Government Accountability Office every year does a report where they analyze duplicative and redundant government spending. Where in federal government across all the agencies do we find a duplication of American taxpayer dollars that are going to certain programs and certain goals that they're paying double for, or if not triple for? How can we reduce that government duplication and just be more streamlined, be more efficient? So you start there. Of course, you know, I'm not going to agree with all, I think the last report is 112 recommendations to Congress just this past year alone. Not going to agree with everything there, but you can at least start from the hard, heavy lifting that they've done in doing the analysis and actually putting numbers attached to it in the tunes of millions, if not billions of dollars. So that slows the rate of inflation, I think, just stopping this government overspending. But then how do you lower prices, actually? You know, how do you lower the price of poultry or meat or eggs or milk? And then with rent and mortgage as well. Well, you've got to make sure that the economic environment, our market, is as competitive as it can be. So putting forth good policy, because right at the end of the day, Lucy, this comes down to policy. It's good substantive policy that we can actually put forward in Congress to make sure that not just on the spending side, but how do you actually increase the competition? Well, it's through not just deregulation, but just smart regulation, making sure that we're not overburdening industries. We're fostering an environment where we allow the market to be as effective as it can be in making sure that there's competition across all industries. That's then going to lower prices as it should. So that twofold problem set, I think, is complex, but I think could be condensed into those two different areas.
How would you work in Congress to increase access to affordable health care?
Yeah. So again, you know, it goes to that a competition piece, right? We certainly want to make sure that things are done safely. We're making sure that we take care of all Americans that need access to the health care that they need. But it's through good competition, right? And so whether it's health care or, for example, you know, you just look at the concern of a lot of retired Americans right now. I mean, even from a standpoint of will their dollars, it goes back to my first point, will their dollars be able to go as far as it possibly can to help them with what they need? When it comes to healthcare, right, a lot of that is, will my Social Security dollars go as far as it can with the healthcare that I need? We certainly want to save Social Security, right? We absolutely do not want to eliminate Social Security. That is a dependent need that many Americans, my parents included, as they look forward to a retirement here very soon, is how do we make sure we save Social Security so that when it comes to their healthcare needs or their housing needs, that dollar can go as far as it possibly can. There is certainly a complex problem that I don't think either side is going to win. There's going to definitely be negotiation. That's what bipartisanship is all about, and doing the hard work. Things like, you know, can we look to see if the Social Security Trust Fund can be invested in equities, not just low rate bonds? I mean, that's something that we should absolutely look into. How do you increase the workforce to where we get more revenue into the Social Security Trust Fund? That's another thing too. We've got a lot of Americans, sadly, that are able to work, that are just not being incentivized to work, or just have made the decision not to work. You get more citizens out there that are contributing to the revenue, so that we've got face the problem that we're seeing, where you know you could have the trust fund depleting in just the next 10 years if we don't change something. Yeah. So increased competition.
What, if any, federal legislation would you support related to reproductive care?
Yeah, so you know I'm assuming that you are talking specifically about the abortion issue, and look, there is no hiding the fact that I consider myself as pro-life, because it's a very important issue to me as a father of four young kids. You know, one who lost a fifth child in a miscarriage.
I'm sorry.
So it's very personal to me. But look, I'm also pragmatic about this issue. We have to be. We also have to be practical on this issue. The abortion issue has been hyper-politicized. It's been hyper-polarized. I firmly believe three things to be true. Number one, that this is a state issue. With the reversal of Roe v. Wade, it brought it down to the states. That is the law. It's a state issue. It's not a federal issue. I'm not going to Congress to make it a federal issue. Number two is that we have to recognize the three exceptions for rape, incest, the life of the mother. Number three is that I think the majority of Americans are not for extreme on this issue. Again, going back to the polarization. You know, what is extreme? I think it's an extreme position to advocate in any way, shape, or form for abortion to be permissible in the third trimester, you know, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth month. But then also, you know, how do you bring this back down to citizens here in the first congressional district when it comes to the touch point to Congress? You know, there was a bill that Born Alive Act, you know, it made it a doctor's duty to save the life of a child born alive in the course of a failed abortion. I look at that bill as a common sense bill, you know, make it a doctor's duty to save the life of a child born alive. But, you know, it's sad that my opponent in this race, he voted no on that common sense bill. What does that show to me? I think that's an extreme position. You know, no matter where he lands elsewhere on the issue, I think that's an example of extreme on the issue. The third point I'm just trying to make is not to make this extreme. I think people want practicality and pragmatism. And that's my commitment, especially on that issue.
It's been more than a year since the Hamas-led attack that killed more than 1,000 Israelis and the deadliest attack on Jews since the Holocaust. The Israeli counterattack has killed more than 40,000 Palestinians. What should U.S. involvement be moving forward?
Yeah, we certainly do not forget the loss of life just now a little over a year ago when the October 7th attack happened. The loss of life, innocent life, should be mourned no matter what life we're talking about, whether it's Israeli or Palestinian or American. It should not be celebrated, it should be mourned. And so we mourn the loss of everyone who has lost their life in the wake of these vicious attacks and this conflict that just continues to brew in the Middle East. What's America's role? America's role is to continue to project strength. And actually is to go back to projecting as strong of strength as possible in the region. We certainly do not want to play the role of Israel for Israel. Israel is their own sovereign nation that has the right to protect its people and to respond to vicious attacks that were done against their own people by a terrorist group of Hamas. And now, as the situation brews in the Middle East, and you don't just deal with Hamas, but Hezbollah and the Houthis, America's role has to be to not embolden those enemies. What is emboldening enemies look like? I mean, Iran is. How do we think the Houthis and Hezbollah and Hamas are being funded? It's through nations like Iran, whose interests are adverse to Israel and to the United States. It's not taking positions where we continue to send American taxpayer dollars to Iran in the tune of billions of dollars. But we also want to make sure that we support our ally Israel as strongly as possible in order to make sure that we secure our interests national security-wise across the globe, especially in the Middle East. So it's standing with our ally Israel. It's bringing back strength into the region and not emboldening our enemies.
As a member of Congress, what laws would you support to address gun violence?
Yeah, look, you know, again, speaking as a father of four young kids, whenever I hear of the tragic stories of mass shootings that happens in schools, I think of my own kids, and three of them school age. You know, it hits home for me, not only as a concerned parent, but as a prosecutor that tried to make sure that I stood up for victims right here in Hamilton County to make sure that whether it's gun violence or any sort of violent crimes, that we held those that committed crimes accountable. It's accountability to our laws. It's to make sure that we support a strong judicial system that can do its role to hold criminals accountable. So making sure that we advocate for good judicial policy that just makes sense to keep people safe. And it goes back to common sense versus extreme. I think it's extreme positions to advocate elimination of cash bail. I think it's you just look at, you know, Cincinnati, where, you know, that has led to problems of recidivist criminals continuing to go out there while they're waiting and pending their case and to continue to commit violent acts. And then when it comes to supporting our law enforcement, you know, is to make sure that we support our law enforcement. We don't call for their defunding. Again, that's extreme, but you give them the resources that they need, and you put them specifically, you know, with schools, is that they are well-equipped with a school resource officer that's there to protect the school and make sure that the kids feel safe. There are common sense things when it comes to, you know, guns that I am absolutely for. Look, it's common sense to make sure that those that have severe mental illness don't get access to guns. Those that are violent offenders don't have access to guns. Again, thinking back of my time as a prosecutor. And we certainly want to make sure that we have as quick and as efficient of intervention as we possibly can for those, especially in schools, that may be trying to commit harm on fellow students. We want to make sure that we have a system as a community that where we intervene quickly, whether it's through supporting administration or counselors, or again our law enforcement. I am absolutely not for giving guns to those that shouldn't have them.
You mentioned immigration before. What should the federal government be doing about immigration policy?
Yeah, I think we need to immediately be securing that southern border so we can, lack of a better word, just stop the bleeding, you know, stopping the influx of illegal immigration. So it's to secure the southern border, send our border agents the resources that they need. The other thing, too, is I think there's no doubt our immigration courts are overwhelmed. Give our immigration courts the resources that they need, the more staffing that they need, and tighten up our asylum claim processes so that we can filter out those that are really not here on any reasonable basis of asylum relief. And also, it's not taking, again, extreme positions, not tightening up protections so that non-citizens do not have the right to vote. I mean, that's you know, a position sadly taken by my opponent. But again, as a product of legal immigration here, I want to make sure that we protect the interest of hardworking Americans while embracing immigration, but done the legal way. So securing the southern border, making sure that we tighten up our immigration laws and send the signal that if you want to come to America, do it the legal way and not the illegal way.
And non-citizens don't currently have the right to vote in federal elections.
Sure, but we can make sure we tighten, we reaffirm that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Jewish Insider in August published a story about an endorsement you received from a former congressional candidate who denies the Holocaust happened. And this former candidate ran a radio ad in 2016 that claimed, quote, "Jewish bankers rig key elections," end quote. How did you end up accepting that endorsement and initially promoting it?
Yeah. So look, the first time I was even made aware of anything that you mentioned, Lucy, I emphatically rejected that endorsement. I did not know any of that at the time that this endorsement list was just published on our website of a list of precinct executives in Hamilton County, precinct executives. Definitely holding accountable those that were on the team at that time that are no longer the team that put that on the website. And look, when it comes to anti-Semitism, you emphatically call it out as soon as you're confronted with it. And that's what we did. As soon as we were confronted with that, rejected the endorsement entirely, called out the anti-Semitism. And I will call out anti-Semitism even if it's from within my own party. And I will do it strongly and emphatically.
And if you win this election, what would your top priority be?
Yeah, top priority would be restoring character and integrity back to Congress as we do the hard work of problem solving, fixing this economy, securing our southern border, restoring American strength both at home and abroad. We can do that through a sense of duty, honor, country, the very things that I serve my country proudly in uniform as a U.S. Army officer.
Well, I've been talking with Hamilton County Veterans Services Commission Executive Director Orlando Sanza, the Republican candidate for Ohio's 1st Congressional District. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lucy. Honor.
Up next, more on The Race. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We've just heard from the Democratic and Republican candidates for Ohio's 1st Congressional District. Joining me in this recorded interview to help provide some analysis of the race and the issues important to voters is Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
The economy is a huge issue for voters this election. Congressman Landsman said there are signs of recovery. Orlando Sanza said it's a question of bringing prices down. So give us a gut check. Where are we with inflation and prices?
So for the 12 months that ended in September, inflation's at 2.4%, which is pretty close to what the Federal Reserve would target, and it's pretty much what, you know, we would expect normally in a normal time. So inflation has largely returned to, you know, where we would like it to be as a country. That being said, prices between February 2020, when, you know, just before the pandemic started, and today, they're up 21.4%. So people have internalized, you know, at the grocery store or wherever they are, restaurants, pretty much any part of their lives, they feel like prices are up, you know, quite a bit more than the normal inflation rate that we're seeing over the last 12 months. They're still thinking of the way things used to be before the pandemic. So, you know, the congressman is correct that, you know, inflation's kind of back to normal, but we're still kind of in this aftermath period where people are still feeling the pain.
How much control does Congress have over any of that, whether it's inflation or prices?
I'm skeptical that Congress or the president have much control over inflation at all. You know, inflation is really a function of the Federal Reserve and interest rates, and that is the strategy that they have had by raising interest rates, the Federal Reserve raising interest rates over the last several years in terms of trying to get inflation under control. So I asked both of them in my own interviews about, you know, about what they would do to deal with the inflation problem. And they both kind of, you know, went to things that are tried and true for their party, right? Orlando Sanza said, we need to stop the overspending in government, you know. And I asked him, you know, what does that actually do in terms of inflation? And his argument is basically that the more the government is spending, you know, it's taking more of your tax dollars, and so you have less to spend, and that would help you with inflation. Landsman says, you know, the administration needs to go after price gouging. He believes that they can take on these big companies that have consolidated power and merged. He also wants to add more money to the child tax credit that was was in place during the pandemic, where people were getting checks every month for the number of children that they had to help out with costs. And so he believes that those things can provide relief for people.
Congressman Landsman's been called out for his delay in reporting stock transactions. He told us it was a mistake he made as a new congressman. It won't happen again. What's your assessment of his explanation of this? What kind of standards should members of Congress be held to on this?
The law is the law. I mean, he's supposed to report those things, and he didn't. But I also don't think that this is any, you know, this is not a, you know, a scandal that's going to result in some big investigation. These types of mistakes happen, and, you know, there's a rap on the knuckles sometimes, or, you know, he eventually did report these stock trades, obviously. He also said, I believe, that, you know, it's not something that he is sitting there controlling and trading the stocks himself. So he only learned about it later. It's not the kind of thing where there's going to be some big investigation and he's going to face like expulsion or something.
Mm-hmm. In our interview with Orlando Sanza, he referenced the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act. It would, this is a quote from the legislation, prohibit a healthcare practitioner from failing to exercise the proper degree of care in the case of a child who survives an abortion or attempted abortion. End quote. It passed the House. Congressman Landsman voted against it. Anti-abortion groups praised lawmakers who voted for this bill. Planned Parenthood criticized the measure, saying doctors already are required to provide appropriate medical care. The CDC, for some context, reported in 2021 only 0.9% of abortion procedures occurred after 21 weeks gestation, which is viewed as the point of viability. What do you make of this legislation?
It's the kind of thing, you know, as you said, doctors are already required to provide care. It's the kind of thing that both parties do when they control legislative bodies, whether it's Congress, city councils, or state legislature. They put up bills for votes to kind of get their opponents on the record, and later, you know, they know, for example, probably that Democrats are going to vote against that bill. And so it's a ready-made attack ad for them to run during election time. Democrats do the exact same thing when they're in control of a legislative body. And so, you know, a lot of heat, maybe not so much light there in terms of actually doing anything that's not already required. Another issue in the race, I think, you know, that has been brought up is, you know, whether it's, you know, whether Congress should make it illegal for undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants, depending on how you prefer to describe them, you know, to vote. It's already illegal. You can't vote if you're not a citizen. So it's a kind of thing where you put that up for a vote, you know, your opponents walk into a trap and you run an attack ad on it. And I think that's clearly what's going on here.
Well, it's like you read my mind, because Orlando Sanza also talked about the need for legislation to ensure that people who aren't citizens can't vote. There was a measure related to this on the floor in Congress. He alluded to his opponent not supporting that legislation. Is this, do you think this is just another example of legislation like that? I mean, non-citizens aren't really voting in great numbers in elections.
They're not allowed to vote.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think there are, I think probably what Sanza would point to, you know, is that there are some jurisdictions, not in Ohio, of course, but elsewhere, who, you know, local jurisdictions, cities, townships, whatever, who may have tried to allow non-citizens to vote in those particular elections. You know, perhaps this legislation would deal with that, but in Ohio, in Cincinnati, Ohio, in any other jurisdiction in this district, the first congressional district, illegal immigrants cannot vote. It is not allowed.
You've been doing, you know, reporting on this race, analysis of this race. What's your take? What is going to be the kind of difference maker in this race in terms of who wins?
You know, I think that Congressman Landsman really has the advantage here. He is the incumbent. He has raised a significant amount of money. You know, as we're taping this, the deadline is coming for reporting of those numbers. I think he's going to kind of show that he's way ahead of Orlando Sanza. So Sanza is definitely the underdog, and the national wins, you know, how they kind of appear in Southwest Ohio. Hamilton County is a blue county now, solidly blue. And so, you know, this district is, you know, Democratic by about 2 percentage points on average. And I don't see any deviation from the partisan record that is being built in Hamilton County towards the Democratic Party. So I think he's got the advantage in terms of that. You know, I don't think there's any one issue really driving this race. It's kind of been a lackluster campaign. And so, you know, all things being equal, unless we see some major political surprise in the last 3 weeks here, and people are already voting as we're speaking, I don't really see anything really shaking this race.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thanks so much for your time today, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
For more election information, check out our voter guide on our website, wvxu.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.